We have
Christina Thomas back in the studio, Louis's amazing daughter, who's working on the island, also studying, working towards a master's, and also an incredible cultural learner and sharer of information. So yeah, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So one of the things that's kind of fun to do while we're sitting here with your amazing dad, sorry, I probably say those things a lot, those things, amazing, and you know, but it's really because I feel very fortunate to have been a friend of your dad's for all these years, and he's been so generous with sharing information, stories, legends, knowledge with me. I've just been so lucky. So yeah, I feel like this is a real gift that you and your dad together in the studio here are willing to share and talk to each other and learn from each other while we get to witness that. So today, tell us what you want to talk about, Christina.
Well, I don't know how much my dad will be willing to share, but he mentioned something in our last session where he feels that he doesn't really want to talk too much about his early days when he was up to no good. But I wrote when we first started that I think it's important to share those stories and your reflections of it, not only for the education of other people, but for the experiences of our communities of Indigenous people. In our last session, I talked about how our graveyards were full of people who passed in their late 20s, early 30s, and you were able to live the life that they did and then continue on and do the work that you do. So I guess I kind of want to ask you more about that. You share those stories very loosely with me, and we don't need to get into the details, but I guess I just want to know your reflections on that time in your life and how you got to be where you are now.
Like I said, you know, I think I did mention it a few times in our past interviews, you know, the alcoholism and our reserves back in the day. I grew up with an alcoholic dad. There wasn't a weekend my mother was beaten. And I only swore, as soon as I get old enough, I'm going to beat the crap out of him. And by the time I got old enough, he already passed away. So I think a lot of that kind of that anger still stayed in me, that festering, like a sore. And I think I started taking it out on everybody else, you know, that anger. So I ended up in and out of trouble, you know, in my early years. And I don't know if I should be ashamed of it, I think the reason why I don't talk about it too much is I don't like to influence our young people into kind of leading that lifestyle, you know, the heroism and all of that, you know, being a tough, mean guy, spending in and out of jail all the time, and being a hardcore Indian. Because I never looked at myself that way, you know. When I went to jail, I always had kind of a purpose. In fact, I spent so much time in there, I felt I was getting institutionalized. And that was the scariest part of my life. So I started reading up on criminology, because actually that's where I got my grade 10 was in jail. So I started reading more and more in there. I started reading up on criminology, and it was all a bunch of facts and figures. I didn't care too much for that, it was too boring. So I went right into psychology. Read all the books on psychology, all the different manias you can develop, you know, pyromania, all the weird things that they talk about. And, you know, I kept reading about that. You know, it's kind of fascinating, you know, how the human mind can really sway you into doing things that you don't really want to do. So when I started reading up on psychology, it got fascinating. And I was looking for answers for myself, you know, trying to really discover why I was getting myself into trouble. I couldn't find any answers in psychology. So I figured, well, maybe it was society making me get in trouble. You know, it's always like anybody else, you know, you blame somebody else or something else to why you do it. So I think, well, sociology was my next one. I read every book on sociology. Still couldn't find any answer. So I figured maybe it's back in the childhood. So I started reading every book on child psychology. And from there, no answers. So I said, maybe it's the brain. You know, I don't know how my mind was working then. My brain was telling me different things. So I went to study of the brain, you know, the cortex and all that, you know, and how it affects your mood, your lifestyle. In a way, it kind of gave me an insight as to who I was. But, you know, when the final countdown was on, then I realized, you know, just admitting that I was going in and out of trouble, I think, was the beginning of my healing journey. I think it was admitting to myself that I was deliberately getting into trouble so I could go to a safe place. Because every time I got out, the lifestyle was different, and all the younger people that I grew up with were already older, and I felt I didn't fit there anymore. So I think I was deliberately getting myself into trouble so I can escape to a place where it was comfortable. And I think that was the beginning of my healing journey, you know, and just the self-education. Because I never really wasted my time in there. I didn't sit back in a corner there crying about why I was in jail or anything. You know, I had a lot of fun. I played ball. I'd done exercises. I'd done all kinds of sports. I think that was why I was beginning to like it in there. Of course, I had a few fights. You know, I wasn't hardcore, but I never backed down from a fight. People found out about it. That's why I got along good with everybody. In fact, I got along good with everybody, and I got along good with the guards, which very few people could do. Because, you know, I stated my position, and I stuck to it. People didn't like me being buddy-buddies with the guards. Well, it's their problem, not mine. And no, I was willing to step up for it. And I think that's why a lot of guards liked me, you know, because I was being me. I wasn't being somebody trying to suck up to them so I can get a few privileges. But, you know, it was just being me, you know. I treated them like I treat anybody else. And same with the prison population, you know. I got along good with them. I had my few fights when I first got into trouble, and I stood my ground, and I could back up what I said, and everybody started leaving me alone after that, you know. And life was pretty harsh, I guess, back and then. And a lot of our people were in jail. I knew a lot of people from all over, Lillooet, Lytton, Kamloops, even as far south as Sui, as Invermere, the Kootenays. They shipped some of them over, started shipping some of them over to Kamloops, and all up and down there, right from near Prince George, out in the Chilcootin country and all the Suwapmuk territory. I got to know a lot of people in there, because majority of the people were getting into trouble, and it seemed like it was, you're native, and you got caught drinking and fighting or something, I'll put you in jail. It's out of sight, out of mind. And I think that was a lot of reasons why a lot of our people were in jail, because, you know, they didn't have lawyers to back them up or anything. It was just a matter of saying, okay, you're going to jail, whether you like it or not. Because the first time I got into trouble, we have people in jail there that are jailhouse lawyers. You know, they know the law. They've been in and out of trouble for a long time, and we call them jailhouse lawyers. I listened to my first jailhouse lawyer, and he said, Louis, said, plead guilty. He said, you don't have a record or anything. He said, you get off with probation. So I went up and I pled guilty. I think it was stealing a car or something. I can't remember. It was so far back. And I went in there and they said, okay, 6 months definite, 9 months indefinite. That was my first touch of the law in adult court.
And how old were you?
17, 16. Just a young buck then, 17, I think. And that was my first encounter, you know. And I found that after that, you know, I think that a lot of our people were thrown in jail because they didn't really know what to do with us. You know, we're a nuisance to the court system. So I ended up going to Haney. Well, I went to Ocala, the prison farm, first, and I was there for two weeks grubbing out in the field. And the guard was standing there with a shotgun in his hand. Come on, I want one of you guys to take off so I can do some target practice. Okay. But we were out there with a hoe and out in the field there for 2 weeks, and then I got transferred over to Haney. And I didn't waste my time there. I learned how to be a carpenter. Now I'm a good regular old chainsaw carpenter, as you could see some of my buildings at the house. Yeah, but I learned a lot by myself then. And when you get 6 months definite, 5 months, you get good time off on that one. 5 months, you go up for parole hearing for the 9 months. By then, I think I was already starting to get institutionalized already. Because I started to like it in there. I got charged for instigating a riot. So I was one of the few guys in there, you know, one of the long-timers in there. And they charged me for instigating a riot, so I already lost 15 days. And I lost another 15 days for fighting, so I ended up losing all my good time. So I ended up having doing 15 months all total. So anyway, so to make long story short, I learned how to be a carpenter in there, and then I became involved in sports. Somebody spread word I was a rat, so I spent just about 2 or 3 days a week fighting in the stairwell. Because, you know, if you get labeled something like that, you know, you got to learn how to fight. Otherwise, you're in deep doo-doo. You get the shit kicked out of you. And so I started fighting back, and then they found out about it, the guards. So they took me to warden's court. And they said, you either got to stop fighting or maybe go to a boxing club. Take out your frustrations there. So I'll either get charged or go to boxing club. So I went to the boxing club. And it must have worked, because after that, I never really fought much after that. And I was one of the lightest guys in there, but I was one of the hardest hitters in it. So we had three exhibitions with outside clubs coming in, and I won every one of my bouts. And then this one outside club from North Vancouver wanted me to come and meet up with them when I got out. They said I had a potential of becoming an all-time boxer. And I said, yeah, okay. As soon as I was released from there, that was the last thing from my mind. I got into Vancouver and I partied for a whole week. I don't even remember where I was. I was in Surrey, I was in Coquitlam, I was all over the place because I met a lot of friends when I got out. Partied all over the place. And I came home, and then after that I started going to Kamloops. One of the youngest guys there, me and my brother, Kenny, Johnny. And like I said, you know, we're out of sight, out of mind. But in there, same thing. I had every job available at in the jail system. I even worked my way up. I became a meat cutter in there. I became a head cook. I cooked for 75 people. You know, jobs that you'd never see a native doing, and yet here this little crazy Indian was doing it all. I had a reputation of being crazy anyway while I was in jail, because I think that's what attracted people to me, you know, because I just said what was on my mind, and I being honest and brutal sometimes, and people were attracted to me. Even the guards were attracted to me because, you know, of my, I guess you'd call it charisma. I think I needed that kind of a friendship in order to survive that brutal system. I got charged a few times in there. I took on the biggest guy in camp, and I held my own. Everybody was scared of him. He was only 6'6 and about 250 pounds. I held my own with him, and we both ended up in the digger, they called it, the hole. I lost 15 days good time, and he wanted to be my friend when we got out. I laughed and I swore at him and I told him, go take a walk. And, one of the guards didn't like me, so I ended up taking a scythe after him. He was a big guy too, you know. Maybe there's something about big guys I didn't like. Anyways, I went after him, and they put me into the warden's court for that, and I got lost 15 days and 15 days in a hole. Bread and water. They put you on bread and water for 3 days. Then they put you on meals for 3 days, and back to bread and water, so it alternated.
That's
punishment. But yet I was the only one that survived, because the camp, the digger was out at Rayleigh, and they had a mic. They had a little house there with a cellar, and they had a mic into the office there, and I timed it because they bought my bread and water at the same time they're feeding the guys in the kitchen, all the inmates. And I'd get up high as I can up on that whatchamacallit, start crowing like a rooster to let them guys know I was awake too. Got everybody laughing in the kitchen. You know, that's how crazy I was, I guess. But You know, and I think it was this survival mode that made me do those things. And like I said, I worked my way up there. I got in as a mop jockey. I went to dishwasher, potato peeler, then I went to waiter, then I went to second cook, and from second cook I went to head cook. The only reason why I lasted that long was because the outgoing cook said I wouldn't last 2 weeks, so you know, being a stubborn little monkey, I stayed in there for 3 months, and I did it, you know. Just to prove to those guys that I could do it, you know. Somebody said I couldn't do it, so I had to do it. And cooking for 75 people, you know, wasn't that hard.
You know? He says, oh, my gosh.
Yeah. No, all I had to do was just cook breakfast, basically. I had to fry the eggs and whatnot. And then because I had all the people working under me, they diced and sliced all the fruit, the vegetables, and everything. And then all I had to do was cook the meat. So it was really no big deal.
Pretty sweet deal.
I got to eat. But yeah, I think that's where I learned how to get along with people. You know, you get along good with the wrong kind of crowd, you get along good with anybody else. Yeah. But I...
it's an interesting way of going about that level of communication training.
Yeah.
You're inspiring me. I see what you mean now.
No, it's how you push yourself to do things that you don't really want to do, but you have to do it. Otherwise, it'll never get done. That's the way I look at it. So that's why I'm saying, you know, that admitting that I was getting myself into trouble, I think was a step into the direction of kind of healing myself, deinstitutionalizing myself, because I started to like it way too much, you know. It was a refuge. I was building my way up into federal time, you know, not just months, I was going into years. So I think that was the reason why I kind of quit. And then I and Linda met, and we had started having kids, and my drinking was still kind of heavy. But once we started having the kids, my drinking bouts got smaller and smaller and smaller all the time. And I think that was the reason why. I think one time her and Mom conspired to take me up the WAP to make shakes there, because I was drinking way too much, and they brought me up there to work. I think I was sick for about a week, puking my guts out, and then I started working, making shakes, sweat it all out, and I think I got into a routine after that, and my drinking bouts came less and less. And then when she passed away, that's when, I don't know, I tell people, you know, it seemed like she came to me in a dream. Did you promise to look after the kids? Because she left me with 4, remember? And so I, right there, I decided I'm going to quit drinking. I quit right then.
Mm-hmm.
And never looked back. There are times I felt like, I got to try one, but I'm scared maybe. Yeah, if I try one, it'll turn into 50, because that's the way I was back then. Take one beer, I'd have to have about 50
mm-hmm.
to keep going.
Yeah. What has it been now, 40 years sober?
30-some-odd, I guess, maybe going close to 4. I never count. I'm not a non-believer in that, the AA stuff, you know, where you keep track of, because it seems like you're living on the edge all the time. You know, you're all scared of falling off, you know, and your next drink, you know, because it's like, come and have a drink, come and have a drink. And so I didn't really believe in it. I tried the AA, but it didn't work for me, so I kind of did it on my own, and just saying, okay, enough is enough. Because I've had some guys come up to me and ask me, Louie, how'd you do it? And I said, well, I just put my mind to it and quit. You know, I quit too, but my counselor said, the only reason why I'm drinking is because my brother died. And I told him, the only reason why you're drinking is because you're a drunk. You look for every excuse, good or bad, to drink. No matter what it is, you find every excuse to keep drinking. After you just get leaving, they get jumping out of the car, and then he turns around and he looks at me and says, you know what, Louie, you're right. Which I am. You know, when you're drinking, you find good or bad excuse to keep drinking.
Mm-hmm.
He's no more not with us anymore. Because that's when you talked about the graveyard. I used to be the top box and the cross maker out there. It was about 30 years ago, and I looked up there and I started counting all the crosses I made. I think it was 57 crosses I made. just from our people drinking right there. And then I quit. I said, I'm not going to do it no more. And never did make cross or top box anymore after that, because I was burying my people, you know, from drinking. When you ask about the crosses, that's why, because they could tell I had a certain way of making them. But I've seen too many of my people die. I even seen my own family. My dad got hit by a train. My son got hit by a train. And my girl, drugs. The sad part of it is, you know, I'm supposed to go before you kids. It's the hardest part when you lose somebody. I just will to keep going. And hopefully I still have enough to give some of the little bit of wisdom that I have. Hope somebody learns from my mistakes. Because I see far away too much of it from our young people, you know. Get out in the real world for a while and come back. And you always hear me preach about that. Come back and you make that circle back home. And bring back the knowledge you take and bring with you for the good of the people. That's what I keep preaching about, you know. We get too stuck on the reserve. Just like me, I'm stuck on a reserve. Never been really off of it in my life. I want the kids to go out in the real world and experience what they experience. Because, you know, you could learn more out there, just like you did. Remember when you went to Africa and South America?
Mm-hmm.
It gave you some inspiration, I think, because you came back, you were going to be a nurse or a nurse aide to go help them. And here our people were suffering. I think you don't think you didn't think they were suffering then.
Yeah, it's a real eye-opener.
Yeah, you thought that they were suffering, but you know, I think that might have opened your eyes too as to how much suffering that all our people across Canada is, you know. You think it was just specific to our reserve, but it's right across the whole nation, you know, that you hear stories about it, you know, the water shortage, the housing shortage, the addiction to drugs now. It's nothing new, you know, and it's going to take people like you to help solve the problem, you know. And I think it's going to take a lot of the young people to get off their little skinny little butts and start getting out there and doing something to help, because the answer doesn't come from us elders. It comes from their own. We could point the direction. Whether they take it, that's their decision to do it. I know I've made my mistakes in my lifetime. I think I've learned from it a little bit. There are times when I still get a little bit angry, and that's why I tell people I think I sweat too much. Every time I get that anger, I go up and have a sweat, and then all that anger disappears. I think I sweat too much to be angry anymore.
From the jailhouse to the sweat house.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what the only thing that gives me, I think it's another one of my refuses, you know, to get away from everything and everybody and sit up there and meditate. And because it feels like, you know, they say it's Mother Earth's womb. You remember that little mound? It's Mother Earth's womb. When you come out, you're reborn again. And that's the way I feel. You know, I feel like, I'm back on the right track again. And that anger is gone from me again, and just keep going. But that's what life is all about, you know, is trying to help other people where you can. But there are times I get tired of helping people, you know, and when you get older, I think then things are a little bit different. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm kind of interested to know about when Louis mentioned your time in South America and Africa. I'm interested to know about that experience.
I went when I was in high school with the Meet a Wee Foundation that is since closed, but I went first to Ecuador when I was 15 and then to Tanzania when I was 17, and I spent 2 weeks in each working on schoolyards, mixing cement, sweating it out. And yeah, like Dad said, you know, you go to these places to help in the third world and you think that it's going to be so different, and you go and you realize that, oh my god, in so many ways it reminds me of my backyard. Yeah, the similarities in issues that we have. I mean, we're more united than we are different. So yeah, that really opened my eyes about not only what goes on overseas, but also what goes on back at home. And it changed my trajectory from wanting to be a nurse on the front lines to wanting to work in policy and make those changes in the background to make life easier for the people on the front lines.
Yeah. So really, like, a complete life-changing experience. How interesting.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible.
And perspective changes when you do that, right? When you get out and you think, oh, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be so different. It's going to be so whatever, somewhere else. And then you realize, no, this is the human condition. There's been trauma and oppression all over the world, and the results kind of look the same, right? Well, it's interesting that you looked back at your community and decided, yeah, I'm going to go in this direction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You even told a chief that she's going to take her job.
I did say that once when I was upset in high school.
I don't know. I see that as a possibility. Yeah,
could happen.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the next election? 2 years? Hmm? 2 years is the next election?
Yep. Get cracking.
Oh, one
yep.
year?
1 year?
No, you don't
we'll
have
wrap
much time.
Things up.
When you were talking, Louis, about your experiences, how they led you to kind of come to an understanding about yourself and what you didn't want to have happen, I'd like to know, like, how you figured out what you did want to have happen. Was it your mother? Do you think your mother had that kind of influence on you?
Yeah, I think, and my grandmother. Because a lot of times I think they're still leading me around by the nose. And that's why I'm telling her, you know, it's... Because now I just tell the people, it's... So when you do things, you do it for the right reasons. And a lot of times you get into a predicament where you wonder why you're there. So, but you keep doing it anyway. So I say, well, maybe the Creator sent me there for a purpose. 99 times out of 10, there's always a purpose why you went there to begin with and start doing what you do. It was part of that experience that you learn along the way, what you're going to do in life. A lot of times I wonder, sometimes I was when I was up at Banff, and what the hell am I doing up here? I created some good friends up there. I taught in one school. I talked with the elders up there. And next thing you know, they're still communicating with me, you know, and they want me back up there again sometimes. And I got free room and board up there now. I can go up to Banff anytime I want and take a holiday if I feel like it. Maybe I'll save that for the summer. Yeah, go explore some of the trails and the... That's one thing, I'm not a touristy type. That's my biggest problem. The longest I've been away from home is usually 2 days. I think there's a reason why, maybe there's a reason why you're sitting here today. You never know. It's up to the future to decide what's going to happen. Maybe somebody on the radio might be listening, maybe one of the young people. We might have sparked an interest in them where they'll start to question the way they're living. And maybe start getting different ideas of what to do when they grow up, you know, just like you did, you know, because I remember you on talking about going to Africa and helping them out. You even got interviewed, remember, by what's her name here? But she was working in Africa, and I told her about your work in Africa, same place, wasn't it? Yeah, because she was all fired up to go to Africa and help them out. But yeah, you know, it's surprising what some of the things you do, it might be related and something you do when you go down the road. You just never know. That's why it never comes as a surprise if anything happens, you know, to me. And yeah, I knew it was coming. I'm psychic.
As if.
I'm psychic.
Christina, how do you feel about like this innate sort of decision to do things for the community rather than focusing on your, you know, your individual wants or your, you know, the things that kind of influence you in the way that you don't want them to influence you? Because you clearly did decide that the community was really important to you, and you're pursuing all the different avenues that will give you that kind of power.
I think it was a collection of a lot of things. Definitely the influence of my father and my mother, for sure. She's a very strong leader. Always valued my education and centered my continuing development. Thank goodness she sponsored those trips abroad that really opened my eyes. But when it comes down to it, growing up in community and realizing a sense of responsibility for myself, I think, you know, these decisions aren't necessarily innate. They're something that you decide to do every day, right? Like, it's the way that you were raised, whether you want to call it cultural or environmental, whatever that might be. Yeah, so I don't know. I kind of struggle with it being innate. I think that's something that a lot of young Indigenous people really struggle with, is kind of the expectation that we're going to be able to pull our people out of poverty, out of these conditions that we live in. It's something that me and my cohorts at the university and my coworkers, they're all young Indigenous professionals, you know, we have this huge responsibility that we have to bear. And a lot of it is self-assigned, you know, like we really struggle through this, yeah, kind of like this saviorship mentality that's been assigned to us, but not even by our own communities. Like our communities just want us to be happy and healthy by the end of the day, because that's how we are assured that our communities will be happy and healthy in the future. Yeah. But it really is a challenge, I think, the assigning of that responsibility, because I think it is all...
It all
comes full circle somehow.
Well, I'm going to university. I know all the answers now. I'm going to fix things right now.
Yeah, that's how I felt in my first year, but it fizzled out pretty quickly.
Because I think that, because, you know, when you go in there, you're all gung-ho, you know, I'm going to... That's what I did when I first got on as counselor. Gung-ho, I'm going to make changes. Then I realized I can't. A lot of young guys come off the reserve or leave the reserve. They go out and get the education. They come back, oh, we're going to make changes. We got to have changes. They come back and they can't because the people are not ready for it. You know, I've seen a lot of young people really hurt themselves, you know, come back and make the well-meant. But they couldn't make the changes because the people are not ready for it. You know, you got to build that up, the expectation first with them to go to that change that they need. Because I've been trying to do it for how many years now, and the reserve isn't any better off because they don't really want the change. You know, you got to build it into them, make that change that they want. And it's really difficult. Never come back to a reserve saying, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, because you know what, right away you'll have opposition. It slowly build up that momentum to make the change. You're going to have the education, you're going to have some of the experience into developing that change. And if you go about it the right way, it'll come. But don't expect it to come overnight, you know, because I watched my people for how many years, 40, 50 years. Something that they're, I don't know whether it's spirituality or they're looking for something within themselves, and they don't know what the answers are, and that's frustrating them right now. That's why you see a lot of anger all over. You know, they're mad at chief and council, they're mad at government, they're mad at their neighbors, they're mad at everything else. I think typically they're mad at themselves for not finding the answers of what they really want. Difficult world we live in. You know, even I don't know what the answer is. I've lived here all my life and I still don't know what the answer is, what the people are looking for.
And it kind of goes back to the consensus model that you talked about last time, when you say that communication and consensus is how things happen. Well, if people come in and try to impose a change, there's no consensus. We haven't learned to understand it. So,
Just remember what I said today is, you know, you're going to come back all gung-ho, I'm going to make change. I've seen quite a few of our well-educated guys come back and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Elect me, chief, I'll make the change. It never did happen.
People not yet.
Fought it.
Just wait.
But, people fought them, you know, because they didn't really want the change. Comfortable the way things are.
Well, we're always comfortable in what we know, right? Yeah. So even if what we know is, misery, that's comfortable because because there's stability in knowing, and stability equals security. So that's a tough one to take the carpet out from under somebody and say, no, we're going to do it differently. Like that's, you lost your stability now. Yeah. So.
Well, I tried that too. At least I got them thinking about it. You know, I tried to introduce HASCAPs. I had Marion involved, and I forgot who else. There's a bunch of them from the reserve were working with that guy that had a HASCAP farm. They were shocked when they found out how much they could earn if they started growing HASCAPs, you know, from $250 a year to $50,000 a year. We could make that much? You know, it kind of shocked them. But yeah. There are different opportunities. Is that nobody ever showed them that it could be done. That's what I was doing. I was building up that platform to start making change, get them to understand, you know, from 250 to 50,000, it could be done. But I was trying to introduce them into a different way of thinking. So next person who brings in an idea that, you know, it's workable, it'll make it a lot more, not easier to be able to implement it. Because they know now that they can make more money on their land than just leasing it off. That was my whole thinking behind that. Because I've seen the way our people think, you know, because they want money now. Because remember I talked about that with the big companies that come in. Oh, they give you a lump sum of money, $50,000, as consultant fees. And I reminded, even I just told our chief and council, we got to stop thinking that, you know. We got to talk more about revenue sharing, where we get a lump sum every year from their revenue. It might be more than $50,000 that they offered you in the first place. If you even get 1% or 0.5%, it might be not insignificant, but over 50, 60 years, see, you could budget around that money, because the minute our people get a $50,000, that could be gone in one day. But if you start looking at revenue sharing, and get that money every year, at least you could budget around that. Well, that'll go towards the daycare, or that'll go towards the other building, the multiplex, or whatever they're building. Mm-hmm. That money can go there. But people don't think like that. They want the here and now, but nobody looks into the future as what's going to happen 10, 20 years down the road. And that's what I kind of look at, you know. Where's our people going to be 20 years from now, you know?
Because that time goes like so fast. Yeah. Like all of a sudden you're just there, right? Yeah,
we need more thinkers that just come out of universities, colleges.
Willing to make the long-term commitments and building meaningful relationships, because that's how real change happens, mm-hmm. right? Is through relationships, and those are not done overnight.
Yeah.
Like we've talked about this in some of our other episodes too, about economic development, about how important it is to have this kind of understanding first about what, you know, what we want to see happen in 20 years or 50 years or even like, you know, 150 years. And Louis talks so much about, you know, our children, our grandchildren, and like what kind of world they want to live in and what kind of expectation they might have. That's a tough thing to do, right? To kind of think that far into the future. But that's what economic development is, really, is thinking about how to build stability for the future. And sustainability is part of that thought process, and that's a tough one because we're very extractive, right, as a society.
Yeah. And we're too segregated. Think of the power we had with all the bands here and the people in the community, all of the whole community. The think tank that we have, if we're willing to work together, then there'll be changes made. But there's always that question of power. Who's going to maintain the power? Who's going to hold the power?
Mm-hmm. There's always somebody that wants the power.
I want it all.
So what are you thinking, Christina, now, like having had this time to discuss some things about the past and the future with your dad? Has it altered you?
Maybe not altered. I'm glad that I got it all on tape now, because I think that my dad's stories from his past really inspire me. We hear a lot of stories of the people who don't make it out, right? So I think having somebody who was so close to me in my life who had the resilience and the ability and the self-awareness to dig himself literally out of the digger, I think it's really important for young people to hear, especially as we are the new, generally more sober generation. You know, we don't really have examples to lead by. So I think these stories are important, and I'm glad that my dad put it out there today. In terms of the future, I'm just gonna have to keep calling him to ask him questions, but I am so glad that we have that you are doing this work to record it. I have all of the sessions recorded onto my computer so that I have them in perpetuity, because it is hard living away from your community and not always having that community guidance from your family and those around you. So I'm excited for the future. I am so privileged to be raised the way that I was. I had such a unique experience growing up. Those are my thoughts on that.
I think you did a pretty great job on her, Louis. And the future is kind of wide open for you. This is the thing I've learned about a rapidly changing world, is that people can change very quickly. It's not easy, and sometimes we have to be forced to. but it's there. And when there's really thoughtful people that have a lot of energy and youth behind them, then things are more hopeful. Yeah, I'm feeling like your family has been such an amazing gift to this community. Like, nobody in Salmon Arm could have done any kind of work, any kind of, you know, understanding without the Thomas family. And learning about Sohwetmek culture, learning about land-based values, and even learning acts of reconciliation, which, of course, that's troublesome for us to talk about because we talk about there was no conciliation to begin with, so it's really hard to have reconciliation. But at least we're working towards truth, and that's an important aspect. That's the important aspect. You don't have reconciliation without truth. So we just feel like, I mean, we as settlers just feel like your family and the entire Switzmelf community has been so generous in helping us learn and grow and learn ways of understanding, ways of communication, and that there's hope for the future in that regard here in this area.
The only reason why I brought up that communication too is that came up at the elders' meeting, you know, with the landmarks. Apparently there's a Sohwetmek law out there taught at the university, and all the elders were already putting up their waving their fists. They didn't tell us about it. I'm kind of curious as to what kind of laws they have, you know, because I guess it's protocols, mostly.
Yeah.
That's because I think a big part of it is just the obligation, you know, and what do you do for your community? That's the biggest law of all. That's not a law, it's an obligation, because obligation and law are two separate things, aren't they? And if you break one, you break the other. Because just your responsibility towards your own band, I think, is the law itself.
All of the history that we have to deal with, all of the trauma, and all of the systems that have been put in place that have created those barriers and continue the trauma, like, where does that obligation to fix all of those things kind of end when you have an obligation as part of your culture?
I don't believe that there's any end to the obligations. I think they come up every single day. But when it comes to, you know, kind of reconciling the enormity of the issue, it is about protecting yourself. And you have to learn that at a very young age, or you burn out, or you turn to less than ideal coping methods, you know. So it is a challenge, especially as a young person who has a lot of energy, as you mentioned, you have to put yourself first sometimes. And as selfish as that feels, it's incredibly important for the work that you do, or you lose yourself very, very quickly. You become overwhelmed with the burden of it all. So I guess for myself, that's something that I've learned, is self-protection. And self-protection, ultimately, if all of our community could learn that, we have a stronger community, right? Is putting your needs and having your own self-awareness to do best by you. Like my dad emerging from his troubled days in his youth, like, he had to think about himself. And we have, like, a really, in the English language, it seems very selfish, right? But it is important to center yourself, because we're not just individuals, we are community members at the end of the day. So when it comes to dealing with that, I would say it's an ongoing learning process for me. But when it comes to facing the issue head on, you got to protect yourself moving forwards.
Yeah, I call that survival instinct.
Yeah. Two words sum it up easily.
Just remember to listen to that, your survival instinct. Because your body tells you what's wrong, you know, and once you learn to listen to your body and your mind, then you will help yourself cope with life more easier. Because I knew I was coming down with a cold, so I could learn how to adapt with it.
You've adapted very well today. Thank you, Louis. Yeah. I'm sorry that you're unwell, but you've done really well. Thank you so much for sharing. And thank you again, Christina, for being here. This was really eye-opening for me, too. And I'm hoping that the sharing really helps our listeners as well. And I appreciate that that you're both willing to talk about things that are very personal and just very vulnerable. That's really, like I said, a gift to everybody who's listening to hear those stories and those thoughts.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you to Tracy for hosting this space. I love having all of these recordings of my dad, and now it's really special that I get to have a conversation between us recorded. I'm just so grateful, and thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Louis, I'm so grateful to you. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah. Well, I always enjoy a good conversation, you know. It kind of stimulates my mind a little bit, and, you know, that's what conversations are all about, you know, is to make other people think. You know, you guys gave me a bunch to think about too, you know, and not, it doesn't go just one way. I'm not the guru of everything.
Yeah, you are.
it's what you bring to me is important as to what I give to you. So, you know, it goes both ways, you know, and that's the way everything should be looked at. Your conversation should be looked at as a contribution to each other. And I think that's the most important part of talking to each other.
That's beautiful. That's a great way to finish it off today. Hope everybody's inspired to do just that. Cook's Gem.